This is the second part of the conversation between Phil and Shadrach. If you haven't listened to the first part of this episode, check your podcast feed.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of CPA Review and More. We are pleased to bring you the number one podcast for CPAs and CPA candidates. If you'd like to learn more about how Yeager CPA Review can help you, find us on our website at YeagerCPAReview.com. Now, here's your host, Phil Yeager.
Tell me, when you went to college, what was your major in college?
You know, I was actually in communication and strategy. And when I went into a corporate, what occupied my desk all the time was bringing projects to market and scaling products. That actually put me into the firing line of what is playing out today as a muscle memory. I had to engage a lot of stakeholders. I had to get a lot of buy-in across different silos where people did not necessarily like each other or did not necessarily speak the same language. But because they had common objectives, I was able to show them that, gentlemen, ladies, we're actually on the same pathing, never mind at different altitudes, but we are going in that direction. That's why in my consulting days in corporate, I was able to move a project with a team that was amazing from a zero balance sheet to $300 million, thanks to securing stakeholder buy-in at various levels within 36 months.
Who trained you? I mean, this is always a question comes up. Well, this is great. Very interesting what he's doing. But it sounds like you were sitting at desks and they would bring over these projects and you would have to do the strategies. But where did you learn? I don't want to call this a trade, but how did you gather your knowledge? I mean, is this being done? Well, we know that blockchain, cryptocurrency is, becoming a large part of US. All right.
Yes.
But the question is this, when I ask someone in cryptocurrency, the people in the United States, how do they learn it? Is it taught in the colleges? Who trains these people? A lot of people are totally intimidated by a new field. A lot of the universities are not equipped to teach what you have learned.
Yes.
How does...
Question.
If I decide I don't want to do what you're doing, tell me what I have to do.
That is a good question. You know, sometimes I'm going to use, I'm going to use this scenario. Across Africa, they have a tendency to affectionately refer to me as the blockchain baron of Africa. I'm not sure why they do that, but they do. And what I often tell them is that it took 38 years for the blockchain self that I've become to be in the making. Why I say that is even before college, even before corporate, and even before blockchain itself, I am a villager at heart. My village upbringing is what helped to shape my worldview, because we can't speak about learning a new technology if our worldview is actually contrary to adapting to new environments. If our worldview or our preference or our persona is actually counter transformation in any kind. So back in the village, maybe some of our American folks, when they grew up, they would go to the fridge, fetch the food, they'll go to the cupboard, fetch breakfast, whip something together. There was no fridge for me. There was no cupboards for me. I was the very last of Africa's sustenance farmers who lived off the ground in my generation. So what that did is that it put in a muscle memory of problem solving, of leadership. From as young as five, I was hunting. I was hunting for breakfast. So what that does for you when you are a hunter at 5 years and your KPIs or key performance indicators will determine whether you eat that morning or you go hungry, that kind of like gives you a different kind of training, more in your personality and your worldview. So that's one. And of course, I got to milk the cattle. I got to make my own food from the farm level to my dinner table. I saw that supply chain. So I could connect dots from that. Then you fast forward to corporate. I was thrown in the deep end. I was left out there. I didn't just wait on the desk for this strategy opportunities to arrive. I had to sometimes look for them. I might have begun at the desk, but it was not. And this is a rule for all innovators that don't want to go the route of Nokia. I had to leave my desk and go down into the grassroots and figure out, why is there such a collision path between my private sector colleagues and the public sector government officials and ministers and these powerful people, why can't they get along? So I had to leave my desk and get out there and fold. I had to leave my jacket aside and get involved in all these spats. And that's where the diplomat in me.
Why don't they get along?
They don't get along because I think maybe there's also some ego dynamics that are happening there. There's also a protecting of, is this my project? If it's not my project, I'm not supporting it. I'm not signing it off. But fortunate for me, where I was born, I was not just a villager, but I was born at the intersection of three countries that became states. So I was born speaking all the 11 official languages of my region. I was born interacting, and that was normal. I thought everyone grew up like that. So when I was in corporate, stakeholder engagement, stakeholder mapping was what I was wired to do. So everybody needs to engage in those communication mappings in any profession, because you will need to look at the future of work as a more connected future. The silos are coming down. You are in the US, I'm in South Africa, but we are co-creating value for the audiences of CPA. And that's what the future of work belongs to. You could have looked at some fascinating things on your desk there, but you actually stepped out, and in the best interest of the industry, you thought, maybe I need to bring in that gentleman from Joburg to really stimulate conversation in the right direction so that he doesn't maybe have all the answers, but he helps us to ask the right questions in the context of the fourth industrial revolution that is unfolding all around us and is coming to a cinema near us, whether we are ready or not. So that's a bit of the 38 years of me in blockchain in the making, adapting to change. And I must mention, my ex-colleague from Deloitte ended up with a big problem on my desk in my consulting days. And that problem, when I solved it, it got a lot of heads turning, and it saw IBM fund us to go into blockchain, because we basically went into a part of the industry that I think even angels don't dare to tread there, is the informal sector. I was very comfortable in corporates. I was working in the mainstream economy, very, very structured environment. And then when she was retrenched, she came to me and my consulting practice now and asked my team to say, please, guys, I'm selling human hair extensions out of my handbag. I know that you are black belts. Those are the words she used. You are black belts when it comes to scaling products and brands. Can you help me out? And I said, oh my goodness, I don't want to go there, because we haven't done anything in the informal sector since my village days, and I don't want to fail. I don't know about the audiences, but I don't want to fail. But long story short, my wife and co-founder nudged me a bit, and we took on the project. Within 36 months, we scaled her survivalist entity out of the handbag into four branches, two of them into five-star hotels, and we moved it from $500 to $2 million. She now employed 40 staff. And I must admit, I was blown away when I saw that the quality of life for her and her employees have changed. They were sending their kids to better schools, and they were building their parents' homes out of shacks, out of mud huts into homes. And that's when I remembered, this is why I love Africa so much. This is why I get the fulfillment to make someone's day and change or edit someone's trajectory. So it's not about blockchain. I think it was Lance Armstrong who wrote the book, It's Not About the Bike. So for me, it's not about the blockchain. It's about the outcomes of a better connected industry and an ethical trade corridor, and also a more accountable measure that does not leave the burden of trust in human hands. That's what it's about.
How many businesses do you own?
Currently, we have about three.
Now, when you say we, you and your wife?
Oh, yes. So me and my wife and our immediate Coronet blockchain team, 80% of our time, I think it's the Pareto principle. Pareto principle is that 80-20 rule. So 80% of the time, we are either going through the build sprints with our IBM technical teams across five countries. So we are just tweaking and building what we call a smart horse in blockchain. It's a digital e-commerce platform for Africa. So 80% of the time, we are focusing on that. But the other 20% of the time, we are traveling across the continent. We are doing diplomacy. We are also consulting incoming companies, whether they're in blockchain or not, but they are looking for growth. People, they want growth and they want future resilience. So we have that 20% in our Pareto principle rule where we still consult, because consulting is what we love, and helping to grow and scale entities, whether SMEs or startups or any entity, is what we love doing. So we've kept that. We've kept that leg room for our consulting passion.
Is South Africa ahead of the United States when it comes to blockchain?
I would say not. Whilst our cryptocurrency volumes are up on the consumption side, but on the business side, I would say that even though there has been some pushbacks with Ripple and other blockchain tensions on US soil, but those tensions are still seeing the emerging of what we call blockchain unicorns at a much faster rate than in Africa. Let me give you some numbers. Of the 900 unicorns that exist globally, only 9 of those are in Africa.
Explain what a unicorn is.
Oh, yes. So a unicorn is any startup or any company that has gone past a $1 billion valuation. So Africa is not producing enough of those, but we are changing that. So the US is still leading. I think US is home to more than 400 unicorns, some of them in blockchain, some of them in fintech. So Africa is playing catch up on the production side, but on the consumer side, Africa is the second destination for cryptocurrency volumes by trade or transaction.
Do you go to the United States a lot, traveling, dealing with businesses there? Or is everything done where you are in Johannesburg?
It's quite interesting. A large volume of our transactions, we see US businesses flying into the country, European businesses, post-Brexit. We actually get a number of delegations flying in to our country and actually flying with us out of South Africa into the continent of Africa as a gateway into the continent. So I would even say 95%. We have a lot of businesses flying in because most of them seek to understand Africa better and then grow as using Africa as a leverage. But we are quite open to travel whenever we get assignment to touch down in the US. We had one call to come through to Washington in 2020. Actually, two. We had to go to Silicon Valley. We had to go to San Francisco for a mega conference with IBM and also just add value there with some businesses in the pipeline. That was March 2020, but we had to put that off. And we also had...
We had to go. Were you part of that? We
had to fly out. We had to fly out, but, okay. but we had to amend. We had to amend that travel because of the lockdowns kicking in. Right. And we also had a request to come through to Washington to really outline to some government stakeholders the implications of blockchain for the US and Africa trade relationship. And we had to put that off. But as nations are reopening and retooling, we are expecting more travel, even to the US and beyond. So we are on the lookout for requests in that regard.
Where are you on the list of the top 10 richest people on Forbes?
You know, you're reminding me of Rockefeller. I think he was asked how much money is enough.
I want you to know that a lot of people you're talking to don't even know who Rockefeller are. Yeah, they would. Who would be the Mark Zuckerbergs?
Interestingly, you mentioned Mark Zuckerberg because my former neighbor. Let me put this politely. My former neighbor, Elon Musk, who was born just not that many kilometers from where I grew up in the big city. He grew up in Pretoria in South Africa. I grew up in the Pretoria rural, so that's where I grew up. Let's say my former neighbor is a lot higher up on the rich list than I am at the moment. And I'm okay with that because he's flying our South African flag in Texas, in the US, where he has resettled now after he left Silicon Valley.
Well, you see, I'm trying to visualize this. You grew up in a village. I mean, how many people were in that village?
I can actually tell you. This village was home to, I'm not going to count the household. I'm going to count the football fields. It was about the size of maybe 15 football fields. And then we had our pharmacy, our food pantry, our go-to. I call that the forest. We had a forest that was everything to us. We got our medicines from it. We got our meals from it. We got wood from it. Our energy, we got it from it. That forest was the size of, I would say, roughly about 160 football fields. So it was quite sizable as a value chain for this modest, tiny village where things are done. Phil, I was actually using donkeys as my mode of transport. I'm hoping that is explaining how village this village was. It's almost like, I'm trying to remember that religion. In America, they wear black and they separate.
Amish people?
Amish, yes. So I live like an Amish. I live like an Amish in my upbringing. And instead of horses, I was a few notches down.
Did you have electricity?
I didn't have electricity growing up. Only when I was just about to 10, 12 or 14, electricity came. But even when it came to select homes in my village. And that's when I left for the big city. So I lived most of my childhood. If I put my hand like this in the dark, I couldn't see it. That's how dark it is. Whereas big cities are talking about city glow and all these things. I was in total darkness, but I'm glad because inside was a candle that was a beacon, and that was a beacon of hope. And today it's still glowing, not for me, but for the continent actually.
What was your father? What did your father do for a living?
My dad, I call him a magician. I actually have a tale of two dads. One dad who was my biological, he was never around. And then the dad who actually adopted me was actually the one who was also never around, but he was going to the big city. He was a migrant laborer. So he would go away for large extended periods of time, which actually also jolted me into early childhood independence because he was just away. And my mom actually, who raised me and my four brothers, she was a super hustler. She was entrepreneurial. At any given moment, she was juggling multiple businesses. And she's the one who actually sowed seeds of me becoming a strategist as well, because she would start businesses and she'll outsource them to me. By the age of 9, I was actually running about 5 businesses on her behalf. They were very small.
Normal. This is not normal in your country that a 9-year-old would run 5 businesses or something. I mean, you were the exception, weren't you?
I would say I was the exception to the rule at the time, but I didn't know it. I didn't know it that a 9-year-old could be handling 5 businesses. It was my normal. I was just seeing myself help out mom. And I didn't know that in helping her out, I would learn stewardship. I would learn submission to authority. I will learn being accountable, being transparent. Think about it, Phil. If my mom is coming to do the books, I was not thinking, how can I hoodwink my way? I was thinking, I better lay everything bare because my mother is my shareholder, is my everything. She's my hero. So I wouldn't betray my hero. I didn't know that in learning that, later, I will navigate corporate politics better because I just put my head down and delivered goods and I allowed my results to speak for themselves. I didn't know that's all I was learning. I just thought every kid around the world grows up being told, okay, fetch water, fetch wood. When you are done, run that store over there, run that camera business. I thought that was another day on the planet.
How many Americans are coming to your country? You have a lot of Americans who are expatriates coming here and working here.
Interesting you say that, because where I am now in Johannesburg, in this physical location, I work and live in a place called Sandton, which is regarded as the richest square mile on the entire continent of Africa. So where I am, just in that direction of that wall, about less than 2 kilometers, is the U.S. Embassy. So I actually live quite near the U.S. Embassy in Johannesburg. So we do have interesting trade engagement and trade relations with the U.S. And we also, I'm going to give you an example. Recently during COVID, when COVID hit, and what do you call it, President Biden was actually implementing some reforms after Mr. Donald Trump left the office. One of the things that had happened is that the U.S. actually imported quite a number of our truckers and a number of our agricultural workers, because we are among the best in the world, especially in the continent. So not only are US citizens coming through as work experts and service professionals, but we are also seeing US bring in, especially agricultural extra pair of hands, because our farming is in the muscle memory at a commercial level now for generations. So there is that trade synergy between the US and South Africa, and also between the US and Africa. Maybe that's where maybe the tensions between the US and China are kind of like getting a bit of intensity, because both China and the US have identified Africa as their next tier of focus. So it's the next frontier for those who want to maintain that number one position.
The average person does not know that. How many people are Americans who set up businesses in your country? Or are they representatives of American companies?
That's a good question. South Africa, particularly, has been home to US multinationals from as far back as the 1980s and the 1990s. The very company that gave us 2 funding tranches, IBM, which is just about a kilometer in that direction from where I'm sitting, is an American firm. Your HP, there's many American tech companies that are not only sending representatives, but they call South Africa home, just like how they've established their home elsewhere. So in technology, in farming, we've got, I mean, our agriculture sees a lot of innovation and R&D companies, they call South Africa home. So South Africa as an economy sees about, 20 million visitors a year. A certain percentage of those are actually business tourists. They are coming for conferences, but a number of them, I mean, I still have friends that used to stay in South Africa for about 5 or 10 years. Now they've moved back to the US due to family commitments. So South Africa really has got a presence of US citizens and also US entities that call South Africa home. It's quite a good environment of doing business because of our policies that actually help South Africa to fare better than the US actually during the 2008 crisis. Our policies were a lot more resilient and we didn't have the Lehman Brothers and other dynamics because we were a lot more stricter than anyone on the continent. So South Africa has got its own islands of US communities, if I can put it that way, that I'm glad to call my neighbors.
Sorry, I'm keeping you from your chauffeured limousine outside.
No, it's all good. you are so kind.
First of all, obviously, I've been to South Africa. In fact, since the pandemic, I haven't been any place. But we went to the Fiji Islands once. And typical Western American, you know, you're driving up to the hotel. The village is like, it looks terrible. You know, such poverty, couldn't understand. And then when all of a sudden this hotel appears, beautiful hotel, you know, and we went, we took a tour to Fiji and they picked up this woman along the way and she was our tour guide. Now you have to understand, here is Philip Yeager from brought up in the New York City area who doesn't understand how these people live. So when we were coming back, I said to her, well, what are you doing tonight? Are you going to be watching television? What are you going to do? She says, no, we don't have a television. We're going to sit around the fire and sing songs. Wow. And I said, you don't have a TV set? I mean, this is terrible. And then this was funny. I said to her, do you know Johnny Carson? And my wife said, stop asking me stupid questions. And I said to her, have you ever seen a tall building? She said, no, you know, what? And I'm describing this to her, you know, and I think the people who watch this, they're probably having a lot of trouble relating to this. And my next question is, people are moving all over. For example, if I had a choice of moving out of the States, I would love to live in Amsterdam for 6 months or a year. Now, the question is, would I want to live in Johannesburg and why?
Very good question. You know, Johannesburg, and particularly what's called the Northern Suburbs Basin, which is a little bit, I think Johannesburg, the basin where I'm at, is the largest man-made forest in the world, meaning the amount of trees that were planted here makes this a green belt of Johannesburg. So not all Johannesburg is green, but where I am, it's green. And also, we are actually an economic hub for a $3.9 trillion continent. We do have our challenges, I must admit, Phil, because I think it was in 2020 or 2029 when South Africa, not just Johannesburg, South Africa won the championships that I'm not proud that we won them, of the most unequal, of the most income inequality country in the world. So one of the reasons why I'm passionate about blockchain is because we can't have the gap between the poor and the rich widening.
Right.
I mean, doing the right things, good for them, bravo. But if the rich are actually siphoning value and gatekeeping value through cartels and anti-competitive behavior, they're denying the seat at the dinner table for the poor, then that's where blockchain as an equalizer needs to be in there. So yes, we do have some challenges. We do have some crime elements that we are still dealing with, but it's nothing that makes us a war zone. However, as a gateway into Africa, which in, I'm going to do some numbers because we have a finance environment, in 672 Saturdays from today at this moment, it will be the 1st of January 2035, and the population of Africa is gearing to double by the 1st of Jan 2035 to more than 2 billion. So the amount of positive chaos and opportunities that that is ushering in for any industry, be it finance, be it waste management, be it supply chain or food security, one might want to have a presence here on the continent. And when you look at policy and the ease of doing business, you may want to look at Johannesburg as a place both to live. I mean, we've got golf courses here, we've got sports. We are nowhere near perfect, but you could live, play, and work here and segue your way into the continent and back, because this is a comfortable launch pad. And we've got Cape Town, which is like a paradise on its own. So yeah, we are very well positioned as a gateway into the continent and back, and also to accommodate for family, live, and play on the recreation side.
What's happening in our country is one of the big issues is income inequality.
Absolutely.
But I don't think it's anything like the income inequality in your country. Am I correct?
Wow.
It sounds like the income inequality in your country is really, really bad. Where
it's quite bad. I can give you the numbers. Around 20% of the population in South Africa tends to control 80 to 90% of the resources or the income. So now that leaves the 80% of the inhabitants to only share among themselves the leftovers of the 10 to 20%. That's not the Africa we want. And that is not because of hard work, because what's funny, I had this discussion that I was part of. They said, oh yeah, poor people are lazy, poor people are not working. And one of the people in the room said, listen, when you are enjoying your coffee in the morning, who woke up at 4 a.m., at 3 a.m. to actually bake that fresh bread and make you that coffee? It's the poor. So it's not that the poor are not working harder. Sometimes the poor are not afforded the same opportunities that the A-list elite are actually afforded. Better education, better schools, better opportunities, and the whole cycle repeats itself. So we want to use the equalizer and the trust machine to really lower the barriers to entry, so that if you are best at what you do, your product can be good enough to be brought to market without you being barred at the entrance with a whole lot of quality assurance questions. No, your organic is not organic enough. Your vegan is not vegan enough. What nonsense? If we were to use Bureau Veritas, SGS, ISO standardizations, then maybe you won't even afford that. But blockchain, we are democratizing access. Maybe not now, Phil, maybe not tomorrow, but in a half a decade or more, we might start seeing the tide turn in favor of the majority for the sustainable development goals.
One last question. Is your country having a problem with getting people to work for companies? You're aware of what's going on here in the States. We got like, I don't know how many millions of jobs out there that need to be filled, and people are just walking away from their jobs. You know, if they don't like what goes on, they walk away. That's not the way it is in South Africa, is it?
You know, Phil, out of all due respect, I call those first world problems. Out of the goodness of my heart, I call those first world problems, because us, even though we are a developing economy and we are no longer a third world country, we are quite developed. We are seeing, I mean, just in between 2020 and 2021, 1 million hospitality and restaurant sector jobs were wiped off, meaning people lost their jobs because of the hard lockdown.
Yes, yes.
So if anything, we have an oversupply of quality talent. I mean, we've got oversupply and we've got lesser demand. So as economies are retooling, some of the things that we are prioritizing through blockchain, because if blockchain can't do that, then I don't want it. Blockchain as a democratization to create job opportunities and to also enable companies to grow. Because when companies grow, naturally they employ. Governments don't create jobs. The day governments create jobs, maybe I'm going to stop what I'm doing and apply for a job that the government has created. Governments don't create jobs. Entrepreneurs that are enabled by technology and they are capacitated through policy and other means and through innovative mindset, they create jobs when they grow. So if the biggest challenge that Africa has is how do we evolve informal sector entrepreneurs into the formal economy, because informal economy jobs are not sustainable. And how do we put more entrepreneurs into that boxing ring of the economic arena so that when they're in there, whether they fail and wake up, more jobs will be created. So that's what's a priority on my desk on a daily basis. Help more people to go into industries and also remove barriers where people that were not allowed in those industries can be allowed so that the industries can change and they don't become a big boys club. That's what I'm facing.
Yeah, daily. The American Institute of CPAs here in this country, we're now starting to realize CPAs do more than just books. And in 2 years, they want to change the exams so that people who are going into IT, that will be one form. People want to go into cryptocurrency, that's another form. So they're trying to keep up with what's going on.
I love that. It reminds me of the MBA era when the masters of what do you call it, business administration. From being a general MBA into a specialist MBA, whereby you could have an MBA in supply chains, you could have an MBA in finance. So I'm seeing that the CPA sector is moving towards adapting and repositioning itself to equip leaders of the future. And that's a brilliant move.
You know, I think you ought to open up a school. I'd be your dean.
I'm going to take you up on that. If I even dare say you will be my Dr. Phil, I will dare take you up on that.
I'll be your doctor. Okay.
Definitely.
Well, I take that as a compliment. Thank you very much.
Certainly.
But you better grab me soon. You know, I'm turning 77 this year.
You don't say. You know what? I think I should send you a little bottle so that you can put in there whatever anti-aging that you're on, because it looks like a closely guarded family secret.
It is,
but
it
depending
is.
On me, please send me some.
What are you, 38? How old are you?
I'm 38. I'm actually, by numbers, I'm just shy. I'm just less than 1,400 Saturdays from blowing candles off my 70th birthday. 1,400 Saturdays, just shy of that.
Well, Chadrack, if you ever get to the DC area, you will be my guest for dinner. I actually could talk to you another 2 hours.
I would love that. I will take you up on that. Yes.
I'm not sure we got to the main point of what you were doing, but I hope you gave some people some idea of what's going on with the blockchain in your country. And it is a fairly new area. Okay.
I'm very glad to learn some best practice from others who are leading from the front lines. And you know what? If I may, ahead of wrapping up, if I may remind the CPA candidates, that wisdom that you either adapt or die, beyond CPA, one has to always maintain an adaptive mindset, not just to the world around them in terms of work, but even on the home front. One moment they are toddlers, the next moment they are teenagers. One moment they're busy maybe fighting with their sibling and for a toy. The next moment they say, "Mom, Dad, I'm heading to college." So one has to always maintain that mindset of being in tune with the times and in tune with where the cheese is moving. If you look at the book, Who Moved My Cheese, so that fourth industrial revolution doesn't happen to you as a CPA, but you are part and parcel of the people that are adapting to shape the profession and shape the industries where they are deployed. So I'm saying keep an adaptive mind, keep a very refreshed worldview as you become brilliant at what you do, then technology to displace you.
When I got out of college, there weren't the different areas to go into. And one thing, and I don't mean to be maudlin, but I don't know how much of the new technology I will see. I'm anxious to see where this profession goes. But being that you looked at me and you said, "Phil, you're from the fountain of youth," I feel it could be another 20, 30 years. All right.
You're
probably 128 when I die. Of course, I will look like a prune. You know what I'm saying?
I think there's still more magical stuff in that IT engine that you have.
I can't disclose where it is.
I know. For IP reasons, we understand.
Well, okay, I'll tell you where it is. It's in my village.
Oh, I love it.
Thank you very much for all the kind.
You're so kind. We are stronger together.
No, you're kind. Forget about me being so kind. Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I wish you much success. And I don't think you need any wishing. You will have much success.
And thank you kindly.
I want to thank Chadrack coming to us from Johannesburg, South Africa, and he is co-founder of Parnet Blockchain. If you want anything to know about him, you can go to LinkedIn. And by the way, I didn't mention this, but Shadrach, before the broadcast, said, Phil, tell your listeners, if they do get to Johannesburg, I will take each one of them out for dinner. And I thought to myself, what a generous this person is. I'm just kidding. All right, just kidding. But anyway, I want to thank everyone who watches this. And I want to thank the people in Atlanta, Georgia. Our number one, maybe that's changed. But thank you very much. I try to come up with guests who are personable. That's very important. And have knowledge. Yeah, no one is expecting you to go out after this and start getting into the blockchain area, cryptocurrency, okay? It's actually going to be one of the big areas. It's finally being accepted as currency. If you have any questions, you can write to Shadrach, and I'm sure he'd be very happy to answer any questions. Thank you, everyone, for watching, listening. And remember, every Tuesday, we have a new guest and new topic. And if there's anything I can show you as far as guests, please contact me and we'll try to get the guests that we can. All right? All right. Shadrach, good luck to you. Good luck to your family. And I wish you well and stay healthy. Next time, we'll see you again for another episode of CPA Review and More.
Thank you so much for listening to Yeager CPA Review and More. As a token for our appreciation for your listenership, we'd like to offer you 10% off your next purchase with Yeager CPA Review. Save between $50 to $150 with code PODCAST10. If you'd like more information, look us up on YeagerCPAReview.com. And as always, if you've enjoyed this show, please rate and review on iTunes or your preferred listening platform. Again, thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to you tuning in next time.